another episode of Drop the Mic. I'm Darren Jenkins. I've been around a while. I don't know. It's been crazy, but what a way to kind of kick off our fifth season with an actress who has done a great deal of stuff in film and television and theater, and is doing some cool stuff now. And I'm so excited to talk to Jennifer Preston. How are you doing today?
Hi, Darren. I'm doing really great. It's so lovely to be talking to you today. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm good. It's hot outside here. I don't know what it's like. Where are you calling from right now?
So I'm based in London, in the north of London. It's not been very sunny. It's muggy. But we're only about 22 degrees Celsius. I'm not sure what that is in Fahrenheit, but it's not that warm. It's quite pleasant. It's just very muggy. We get a lot of rain in England.
I haven't been to England in quite some time. I think I was in Cambridge last time I was there, and I still have never been to London, which sucks, but I at some point have to make it there.
Yeah, come visit. It's great. There's a lot going on.
Speaking of U.S., British differences, you're a British-American actress living in London. How does that come to be? Like, how did you end up there?
Yeah, I mean, do you want me to go right back? Because there's quite a story.
I'm kind of curious. Actually,
yeah, I was actually born in Berlin before the wall came down. So that's how old I am. And so my dad was in the American forces, and my mom was working out there. So my dad is the American one. My mom is the British one. And they fell in love and they got married and they had me. And then they were out there for a few years. And then they moved to America. We lived in Key West for a little while. And my dad was still working for the forces, and he kept getting posted here, there and everywhere. And my mom got a bit lonely because the States wasn't really her home and she missed her family. So she would come back to the UK while he was posted overseas. And that was, you know, long before the days of FaceTime and stuff. So it was a bit more difficult to stay connected, I think. And eventually they went the different ways, and I ended up with my mom in the UK. So my American accent started to evolve in this very, very British accent. And people are surprised, when they hear that I'm American. But I have both passports now. And it's like flicking a switch for me, the accent, because
really,
maybe my first native accent was American. And so if I need to switch into an American accent, it is like flicking a switch. Well, so it's really useful for us.
I'm so jealous, because that's the one talent. Like, so as an actor, as of yesterday, I think yesterday I was walking down the street. For some reason, I was like, found myself trying to figure out, like, I heard this woman walk in front of me, and she was saying something to her kids, and she had like this really interesting, I don't know where she was from, but, and it just made me kind of start trying to figure out if I could pick up her accent. As an actor, I think it's like doing physics or something for me.
Yeah, I think it's just how the brain is wired. And I think because I grew up listening to both American and English accents, my brain is just wired to, it's almost like, I know a lot of bilingual people who grow up with parents, and at home they'll speak maybe German or French, and then, out in the rest of the world, they'll speak English, and they're able to just flick a switch. So I have that with accents. And I've lived in different places in the world, and I've lived in different places in the UK, and I pick up accents pretty quickly, which is a great asset as an actor. Yeah, it gives me utility.
Definitely a great asset, because especially when you're, I mean, as an actress, you're I remember when I first started out as an actor, and you're trying to put stuff on your resume that, talents and things you could do. And, I come from a time when you just kind of made, hey, can you ride a horse? Nope. Okay, put horse on there. But I feel like, a voice talent is so much more. Like, they're going to eventually figure it out. Like, if they, if you go on there and like, all right, we want you to do this in an Australian accent, and your Australian sounds like, you know, something from a cartoon or something, I think you're caught. I think they caught you. So.
Oh yeah, they're going to catch you out for sure. I think sometimes the advantage now on your online resume right. is that you can put voice clips. So you can have a little voice clip with American accent, or you know, one with Australian accent, or you know, Northern English accent. So quite quickly, if a casting director is searching for someone who genuinely can speak that accent, then they can go in there. But my agent will submit me for various things. That are on my resume, and then it's really the test. Sometimes I can be rusty, and there are some that are really easy for me, like Birmingham is a really easy one. Northern England is really easy for me because I've lived in those places. But if you ask me to do Welsh, now that's a tricky one. I would not put that on my resume.
Yeah, it was I forget who it was, but I was listening to a podcast recently, and the actor, the guest on the show was, I think, of Welsh descent, and they asked him to be able to, you know, say something in Welsh. And yeah, I tend to agree. That's not like, even if I did was good at languages, yeah, that's difficult.
Man. And it's a whole other language as well, the Welsh speak.
Yeah.
But the accent is beautiful. It's almost musical. So yeah, it takes some practice, and it's just not something that I can click into. Now, I mean, if you give me an accent I can't do, then of course I'll practice it until I can read the lines, but it wouldn't be something that I could improvise in.
So, you know, with that in mind, like, you know, I want to go back a little bit. So, you know, when did you start getting into the theatrical arts? Like, was it in high school, grammar school?
Yeah, so I would say it was actually in junior school, because it was just my mom and me, so an only child. I was pretty shy, and my mom was worried, you know, that because I was an only child, I was shy, she wanted to give me a hobby which would bring me out of myself. So she sent me to acting classes, like workshops at the weekend. And honestly, I would highly recommend that to anyone as something to do to give you confidence, because now I can walk into any room or talk to anyone. When I was younger, that was difficult for me, but it gives you a kind of confidence to perform as a different character. It allows you to know that you're going to be able to survive any situation, really. And actually, my two sons, who are now teenagers, and hate it when I talk about them, but they, at the ages of 6 and 9, because there's 3 years between them, when we were living in Prague, which is a different story, they both started acting. Because they saw an opportunity that was posted at school, and they said, I really want to act. It was professional. It was TV. And they auditioned, and they got the part. And my son, both of them have done a lot of TV and film as well. I mean, I would say their resumes are as good as mine. They stopped now because, you know, school and other hobbies have got in the way. But my oldest son was actually on the West End as Little Harry in The Cursed Child.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was really fun. So I've seen that like 20 times. but my point was that they loved it. And naturally, especially my younger son, who's now 14, he's a really shy kid. And it's given him the ability to talk to anyone, particularly, you know, adults, and work in a professional setting. He takes it very seriously. I think it takes a lot of courage to be on a film set, you know, with a big studio professional film set. You know, he's been on the set of Carnival Row with Orlando Bloom, and he's, you know, they were both in a film with Jessica Chastain. And so these are big sets, and yeah, they held their own. So good for them.
Wow. Yeah, I got to tell you, I totally agree. I remember, so I didn't get into acting until kind of what's considered probably late. Like, I think I was probably admitted to myself that I wanted to do it was I was probably 22 or 23 years old or so. And I'd given myself a finite amount of time to get my first role. I said, all right, if I don't get my first role by the time I'm 25, I know it's time for me to move on and do something else. And so I I don't know how familiar you are with American comedy stuff, but there's a show here, like a talent show called Showtime at the Apollo. It's
it's a
brutal experience for anyone, whether you're professional or not, but
yeah,
an opportunity came across for me to be on the show, but it was as a stand-up comedian. I'd never done stand-up comedy ever.
That's tough.
Yeah. But I decided I was going to go on there and do it as just the proof to kind of give me to say, if I can get up there on that stage, I can do anything after that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, so I did it. I got booed off really terribly. It was terrible. It was a terrible experience. But I actually came out of it with a lot of confidence after that, because I feel like, to your point, if you're in front of that camera or you're up on that stage, just that effort alone should validate you as a person of girth, you know, of fortitude.
Yeah, I have kudos to you. I have so much admiration for stand-up comedians. I think that is much tougher than when somebody gives you, you know, lines to make your own and a script. I think to go up there and tell a joke and to wait to see if someone finds it funny, that's tough.
Yeah.
But what I was headed down a route when I was younger. My first professional gig was when I was 14. It was a theater gig. It was Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard. I played Dunyasha. It was great. I lived in the Midlands, not too far from Stratford. And a director, Bill Wilkinson, who used to work for the Royal Shakespeare Company, was directing a play, and I auditioned for it. It was the first time I got my equity card, the equity being the British Union for Actors.
Yep.
And I just thought, that's it, I'm on my way. And then that started my professional theatre journey. However, I was still at school, and I was still studying. And I think my mom, because she didn't have any background in theatre, we weren't connected as a family to anyone who was in this industry. And that's a little bit intimidating. And we weren't financially well off at all. She really struggled as a single parent. So she sort of wanted me to have a backup, you know, a plan B. I think a lot of actors often talk about plan A, plan B. So although I had an acting coach, she really wanted me to go to drama school in the UK. It's actually quite expensive to go to drama school in the UK. I don't know if it's the same in the US.
It's expensive here too,
yeah. And there weren't scholarships or anything available at that time, or certainly nothing that we knew how to access. So my mom was worried about that and said, why don't you go get your degree? Because I was pretty good at remembering things, which helps with lines now. And I was doing well in my schoolwork. So she said, why don't you go off, do a degree, and then you've got a fallback, you know? So of course, then you start going down a different avenue. And I think what might be interesting to you and your viewers is the fact that I did go down a completely different route. I studied law. I went to Germany and did part of my degree law in German, which was crazy hard, but I did it. So I speak German as well.
Oh my God.
And yeah, so I qualified in law, decided I didn't want to be a lawyer. I loved the idea of being a lawyer because basically I was in love with Victor Cifuentes in LA Law. Do you remember that?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So I grew up and I was like, oh, Victor Cifuentes, I'm going to be like him. He's my idol.
Is that Jimmy Smith?
Yes. Yeah, who was more recently in The West Wing, which I also love. But yeah, he's a wonderful actor. So he inspired me to do my law degree.
Wow, that's okay.
Right. That's awesome. And but then I realized that actually law in the UK is very different from law in the US. Yeah. You know, it's very backwards looking in the UK. You're always looking for precedents. You don't, as a solicitor, get to stand up in court and, you know, be all theatrical. That's very much an American style of being a lawyer. So I was a bit disappointed in that when I found out the truth. And so I ended up going into banking, of all things, and then veered towards the people element of that. So I then got into HR, training and development. I did a lot of, you know, public speaking within the company. People kept saying, you really should be, you know, on stage. You really should be doing, you know, and I would be the one doing the media training, some of the media announcements, you know, working on all of those sorts of things. And also, you know, as a hobby, I was still keeping my hand in. I was still taking a few classes, acting classes, just because it was still my dream. And I thought one day I'll get back to that. Mm. But the thing is, it took me like 30 years to get back into it. So,
really?
Wow. Yeah. So I've only actually been back in the business for about 7 years. And, you know, and I can talk about how I got back into it, but I think, you know, I when I talk to other people, they find it inspiring that I could come back into the business. And more people I speak to have pursued a corporate career and then come into acting and are actually doing pretty well because they have all this life experience. And maybe they're not, their self-confidence is more developed than somebody coming straight out of drama school. You know, I've spoken to a lot of people, mental health within the industry is something that I feel very passionate about. Mm. I mentor a lot of younger actors because I'm also a life coach and I also do some acting coaching as well. And I mentor a lot of younger actors and, you know, confidence is a massive issue. Yeah. And sometimes at drama school, they strip you down to build you back up again.
Yeah.
And they do a really good job at stripping you down, but they don't do such a good job.
Building you back up. Yeah.
Building you back up. And it can take, I mean, you know, because you know you've been an actor, it can take a long time to build up your career. Every rejection that you get, you know, it's just a knock. But when you're a little bit older and you come back into the business, it's a little bit different. You've got more life experience, you've got other successes to validate you, you know, you don't rely on others' opinions as much.
Yeah, I think, that there's that piece of you that as an older actor at that point in time, you've kind of built up more of a resistance to, you know, negative feedback in a lot of ways, you know, because if you've been in the business where you've probably fallen several times, you know what I mean? Like, and at that point you go, it's old hack. It's just, you know, part of the game. And, you know, and also I feel like people just become more bitter when they get older. So they don't care as much. They're like, what? Okay. Whatever.
Cynical.
Yeah. But not in a negative way, but more of understanding that this is not the end of the world when it happens to you. You know what I mean? Yeah. I think that's an important part of being a creative person in film, television, acting, art, photography, you know, any of those arts where people have to judge what you're doing. You don't necessarily have to take it personally anymore. You kind of just go, well, all right, I'll just try it again next time.
Yeah. And I mean, you're judged very much on your appearance as well. Yeah. And I think, you know, actually when you're younger, that means a lot more to you. As you get older, you're like, okay, I'm getting older. That's, you know, that's okay. I think it's slightly different in the US to the UK, because in the UK, we like our actors to be quite gritty, you know?
Right.
And I think we like them to be a bit more glamorous in the US. But I think that's changing too. I think there's a more accurate representation of how everyone looks. You don't have to look perfect for every kind of show. And in fact, you know, somebody like the wonderful Kate Winslet, who I admire tremendously, you know, she's come out and talked a lot about how when she was a younger actor, people talked about her weight, people talked negatively about her appearance. It was very damaging, and that can be very damaging. And yet now, you know, she's a multi-award winning actress. She's just so amazing. And she was in Mare of Easttown, you know, really stretched back, looking, you know, not her best. She's still amazing. But I love that she's so brave to do that, because that's a real person and a real representation. And it's so much more interesting to watch people's real vulnerabilities. You know, people don't have to be perfect. So, well, that's a great thing.
The one thing, so The one thing that has changed over time within the industry is technology. And now we have these 4K, 8K cameras and all, you know, that show you in the most vivid detail possible. And so what I loved recently is that very many actresses and actors in Hollywood have just purposely said, this is me. You know, I'm not, you know, they, like you, I feel like you kind of have to do that, like to just be you and just not worry about what, because to your point, like I feel like there's a certain value to being older and grittier and because I feel it creates a realism to the actual characters you're playing. Cause nope, I mean, there are like maybe a handful of actors and models on the planet who just are so physically gifted.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I cannot possibly compare to those people, right? You know, there's no, I'm not ever going to be
there. Yeah. Astonishing. And you know what, actually sometimes when I'm watching people like that on the screen, like Charlize Theron, somebody like that who's just so divinely beautiful, like a goddess, when she is looking her most beautiful, it's kind of distracting. I forget what she's saying and what the story's saying because she's so beautiful.
Yes.
But she's a chameleon. You know, she's done a lot of parts where she has worn prosthetics, where she's put on weight, and where we can really see her performance shine through because we're not distracted by perfection. And I think that's wonderful. You know, I love the fact that people's quirks, people's uniqueness is now what's making compelling and interesting stories. I mean, you look at The Handmaid's Tale. I just finished watching the last, the latest season of that, not the last season, thank goodness, one more season. Right. And, you know, Moss, she's not, I mean, I think she's beautiful, but she's not conventionally beautiful. And yet her face is so interesting. Right. And they do so many close-ups, like real close-ups in that show. And you see like every pore, every crinkle. And it literally creates texture. You know, it makes it richer, I think. And also you can relate to the people much more. I applaud that. And obviously as an older actress, yeah, bring it on.
Well, you know, so we're talking about good shows and, so what's funny is when I learned about you, I didn't know at the moment that you were on the show that I was actually watching. And I was just like, oh, wait a minute. Yeah. Which is, is such a good show. And we're talking about The Wheel of Time, the Amazon Studios television series.
Yeah.
Where you play Mistress Grinwell, right?
That's right, yeah. I mean, it's such a privilege to be part of such a huge, epic story. Yeah. Yeah, and it's such an amazing show. I mean, I loved my time on that. I was cast in it. I was living in Prague when I met a couple of amazing casting directors, one of whom is a very good friend now, Nancy Bishop. I was cast in some shows whilst I was living in Prague, but it was actually when I came back to the UK that Nancy asked me to audition for that part. And I got it and then flew back to Prague to film it. But I mean, you know, it's such an epic fantasy series. I love fantasy. Books are incredible. I think they have done justice to them so far, certainly, you know, in the first series. And it was amazing how much fan interest all of the casting got. I mean, my role was relatively small, but it was just a joy to work with all of the main cast. I had to do some training with the stunt team to do some archery. I didn't actually have to shoot my arrow in the end, but I had to hold it correctly because my character was someone who really knew how to use her bow and arrow. So we needed to be convinced by that. But yeah, that was a really fun show to be on.
I am jealous, of course, because I think that show to me is kind of like part of this new ecosystem of film, of content, where like these big grandiose adventure type projects, and you know, and like obviously what Marvel's doing and all these other I think it's just I love right now in television and film, because there are such interesting stories being told. And I'm wondering, like, so with all of this being done and on the screen, like, are you still having time to do more theatrical? Like, where does theater lie in your kind of like ecosystem of kind of things that you're doing?
Yeah, interesting. Theater was where I started my career. Hmm. And I think it's a really good training basis. And I think that's why British actors are so in demand, because often theater acting, stage acting is what they start off doing. And it is quite different to screen acting in that you're projecting something out to a big audience. You project your voice as well and your expressions. You also do everything live. You don't get a chance to redo it.
Right.
And also the blocking is really important. Whereas with the stage and screen, I mean, it's just, I don't know, some of those key skills really help you with screen acting, but it is definitely a different skill set. And now that I've been doing that, to answer your question, I prefer screen. I don't know, it's just, it's so much more nuanced. You know, every little thought is behind your eyes is captured on the screen. So whilst on the stage, you might be upset, so you have to be upset, you know, on the screen. You don't move your face, you don't move your body really. Maybe it affects your breathing slightly, but in dramas, unless it's a soap opera, but if it's just a drama, you're just gonna see it all take place behind the eyes. Again, referring back to Elizabeth Moss, she's one of the great actresses who does this, where she's completely still, but you can read everything in her eyes. You can read everything to the extent, whereas if you forgot your line, you can read that. You could be like, that person looked important. They didn't panic. So I like it because it is so nuanced. You know, it's a real kind of a skill to perfect. I also just love being on these amazing sets. I mean, Wheel of Fortune, for example. I mean, they spent so much money and had so many amazing artisans on working on those sets. They, you know, it is like stepping into an alternate universe. And of course, that was important because they needed to be honor the books, you know, and honor that world, honor the fans. And I really think they did. And all the costumes, you know, you do get that to some extent with the theater, but yeah, they just have more to play with when it's screen. And also, it's really, really technical art, screen acting, because I mean, you all know this as well, but you know, you come with your performance in mind, and then it's all about the camera capturing you from a certain angle and coming in and hitting your mark and making sure that you got the right light in the right place. And so you can make a really emotional scene, and you might have to replay it like 12 times to get it right technically and still bring a consistent, truthful performance. So I like the challenge of that, I think.
I you know, so I came into, you know, acting kind of backwards in a lot of ways, where I actually started out in special effects, and I was doing special effects before. Like, I wanted to be in acting, but it just so happened that I got special effects first. I worked in that for a couple of years, and then I went to become I was a PA for a number of projects, you know, and then somehow Spike Lee somehow got my photograph or something, and someone called me about, I thought, to be honest, I seriously thought it was a joke. I thought that someone was messing around with me. Someone called me like, hey, Spike Lee would like to have you come and audition for, you know, Malcolm X. So I was just like, yeah, okay, yeah, sure, whatever.
Wow, what an opportunity.
Yeah, it was a very small part, and but what it taught me was, to your point, is that it is very I don't even know how to play, like how acting on screen, because I had done a little bit of theater, not a lot. To being in theater to me was blah, whereas being on film was blah, you know, very focused and like almost targeted in the approach of each scene, especially depending on what directors you've worked with. You know, some of our are quite micromanagement, and some of them are kind of like very, you know, they're almost kind of theater-like in a way where they want to see like several things from several experiences and kind of rely on the editing to kind of piece some of it together like afterwards. But I love that. I mean, I think the best part of it to me is afterwards seeing the whole thing. And
Absolutely.
Your brain seeing, oh, okay, I see how this fits, all the puzzle fits together.
Yeah, definitely. And you get directors, in my experience, who either are very much big picture, very much people who have each frame by frame and have a vision and walk very closely in partnership with a cinematographer to get this incredible vision and actually leave you to do the performance, you know, leave you, they trust you as the actor, they've seen your audition and they like what you did and they kind of let you go for it. And then you have other actors who let the cinematographer do the cinematography and they're very much focused on bringing out the narrative and getting the you know, your peak performance. Both are wonderful to work with. Nice to see what you're going to get.
What is there growing up, was there anyone that you kind of looked towards as an inspiration, say, oh, I love this person, or I love what this person's doing, and I want to, you know, I'm not trying to copy, but
Well, so my mom and I used to at the weekend watch all the black and white movies. Ooh. So, you know, I grew up with old Hollywood on one side and then Star Trek on the other.
So, oh, we're going to be best friends.
I know, I'm a Trekkie, yeah. So on the, I love science fiction. So on the one side, I love the, you know, old Hollywood, and on the other side, I'm a science fiction buff. Mm. But I grew up with that sort of image of the movies. But the people that I gravitated to are the actresses like Katharine Hepburn. Actually think that Audrey Hepburn was a real inspiration because of the way she grew up and all the adversity she suffered and how she came out of that stronger and all of the charity work that she did. And then someone like Katharine Hepburn, who was so far ahead of her day in terms of being a woman in that industry and not accepting, you know, just the kind of ditzy female parts. I Love Lucy, you know, amazing comedian, and she was really, Lucille Ball was kind of the driving force behind that. So I mean, I love that. I've always loved strong women, and they were idols of mine.
I always wonder what Katharine Hepburn would be like right now, man. She would be killer on the screen, right? Like if they could pick her up from there and put her in, you know, the middle of a, you know, something here, oh, it would be just wonderful. Cause she was such a amazing, like she, when she was on the screen, she was so powerful. She just captured your attention, but not distracting. You know what I mean? And I think that's a very tough thing to pull off.
Yeah. I think she was, for her day as well, a lot more grounded in reality, because, you know, I mean, the style then was to be a lot more heightened, you know, and now we look back at those movies, I can't get my kids to watch them because they're like, oh, they're not realistic at all. They're just so over the top. And they are, when you look back at them, the acting, the style of acting is so different. We've become so hyper real that you could almost be watching reality TV. Or just be a fly on the wall watching something, which is incredible, and I love that style of acting. But you know, that wasn't how it was in old Hollywood. It was it was controlled. It was very mannered. You know, it was almost like theater. They got a lot of their actors from theater. But I think Katharine Hepburn was one of the people who was, you know, creating, was trailblazing, a bit more grounded, a bit more real, even though, you know, she's still mannered, she was a bit more real than the others. And I think then you've got people like, obviously, Marlon Brando,
yeah,
who was incredibly real. People are like, why does he mumble all the time? But you now look back at some of his work, right?
Right.
You look back at some of his work and you just think, he was being so much more real than everyone behind, around him. Yeah. So he was a real trailblazer. Things started to evolve and those sorts of performances became a lot more sought after.
You know, I there's a park here in New York City, Bryant Park, that does outdoor movies on Mondays. And this past Monday, they actually showed Roman Holiday. And so I was sitting there waiting for the film to start, and there was a young lady who was standing there on the phone in front of me, and I could hear her on the phone. She goes, I guess someone must have been asking her, like, what movie's playing? And she goes, Roman Holiday. I don't know. It's some old-timey movie about travel or something. I don't know. And I was just like, what is going on? Like, this is a Hollywood legend. She's a classic. She's one of my favorite actresses. I mean, come on. And so beautiful. I mean, she's just, you know, just so, you know. So you like science fiction?
Yeah, I do. That would be my dream, actually, to land a series regular role on some kind of science fiction.
Oh, I could see you totally doing that, for sure.
Like, I've auditioned a couple of times for Silo. So now I'm just trying to manifest getting another audition in series 3 or series 4, because I think it's going to roll on for quite a while, and try and land something on that.
I think you... And maybe I'll speak this to truth for you. And hopefully we'll see. Knock on wood and all the good stuff. But I would love to see you on Strange New Worlds.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's they're doing some good stuff on Star Trek right now, which is cool.
I mean, that would be the dream. I would love that. And I could do the American accent. I could do the British accent. I can do an accent.
Yeah. And you know how to fire arrows. I'm sure they have arrows in space.
I do. Also, I know how to fire a gun. I had to load and fire a gun and do a bit of fighting on 12 Monkeys, not the film, but the TV series. I worked with Emily Hampshire, who she's just amazing. She's a real superstar. I loved working with her.
12 Monkeys, yeah. That is number 7 of my favorite films of all time. So for you to have done the actual series as well, which was actually very good.
I really loved it. So I was already a super fan of the series when I got to, because I think I was in season 2, I'm trying to remember now, but it wasn't the first season. So I'd already seen a season. I was like, oh my God, I love that show. And then I got to be in it. So that was really fun. Again, it wasn't a big part, but it was a couple of episodes. It was really fun. And as I say, I got to work closely with Emily, and she's an incredible actress. And then after working with her, I saw her on Schitt's Creek. Brilliant masterpiece.
So you've not done Law and Order yet, right?
No, I haven't. So I haven't done a lot of stuff in the States yet. A lot of what I've done has been working out in Prague or out here in the UK. I have been auditioning a lot more for American stuff recently. So fingers crossed, I could do.
Oh, they'll see this and you'll get it. And once they see this podcast, it's done. They're going to be flooding your inbox with all kinds of.
I would love that, Darren. That would be good. I've done some soaps over here in the UK. There is a very popular soap called Coronation Street that's been running for.
Oh, yeah, Coronation Street, yeah. Sure.
And I've also done Emmerdale Farm, which is also, you know, a very well-respected, long-running drama. And also a series called Casualty, which is one of our medical dramas, which is not known as a soap. It's known as continuing drama. But they have some good stories. So, yeah, I like a good medical drama also. I mean, you know, I loved Grey's Anatomy. I loved ER. people.
I think there's like Grey's Anatomy, ER. There's a bunch of like what I call like those medical procedurals. What they're just, I mean, there's the breeding grounds for great acting. Like so many people who have been on these shows have gone on to do such amazing things, both in front and behind the camera, which is always amazing as well. So do you hope to be behind the camera? Like, I know you've done a short. Would you do a feature or TV show or?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I love being in front of the camera. I have to say that that's where I really come alive. But it was a really amazing experience to make my own short film. The film I made just briefly was called Milo. And one of my sons was in it, actually, because we shot it during COVID. So it was, he's a good actor. He looks like me, he could play my son. And it was just a lot easier with the bubble, you know, that we had, the restrictions. But I made it with a couple of groups of friends who are production companies, Tripod Productions and Creative Lions. And we made it on a shoestring, but it was about, I wrote it. It was about grief and loss and mental health. And we worked with two English charities who support people with grief. And we worked with two American charities to help us shape it into something which they could also use. And we're in talks with one of the charities about taking it into secondary or senior school, high schools, to use as a learning tool with a learning pack to support it, to help young people to talk about loss and grief and, you know, where to get support and how to open the conversation, whether it's you that's lost somebody, whether it's one of your friends that's going through the process. Because I think it's one of those topics that people don't really talk about that openly. And I think it's really useful to kind of know different ways to bring it up. So yeah, that was it. It felt really satisfying to do something that actually could be useful and has resonated with lots of people. And I did love seeing something that I'd written come to life. That was an amazing gift. And it's been shown in a lot of international film festivals. We've won a number of awards, best film, best actress, best script, best editing. So yeah, it's done really nicely. So that does spur me on to think maybe I could do something else. And I have written a pilot, a TV pilot. But yeah, I just kind of at the moment,
focus on
it's very hard to get these things seen. But what I think, the first thing I will do is get a group of friends, we'll do a table read, we'll see whether writing works, whether writing doesn't work, and then we'll see if we can get it in front of somebody who can get it made.
What you should do is write your own science fiction movie. And
I have actually written a science fiction novel, which I haven't published yet. I've had a few agents look at it and had very nice feedback about it. But I wanted to write a trilogy, and so I'm only halfway through the second book at the moment. But I could definitely see that on the screen, like a Netflix series or something like that. So yeah, it's a young adult science fiction.
That's incredible. Looking for, like, you know, when it comes out, I love science fiction. I'm all about it. I just, you know, you name it, I've watched it probably. Like friends will, like, on Facebook, they have, like, they always put like these lists of, hey, how many of these films have you seen? I'm like, I've seen them all. 60, 70 of them. I've seen them all. That's what I do. It's what I am. And, you know.
I will watch great science fiction. I'll watch mediocre science fiction. I'll watch bad science fiction. I don't care. I just watch it.
She's like, I don't care.
Says, oh, you'll watch anything, and I'm like, yeah, I love it.
but here's the thing, right? As an actor, I feel like it's almost like being a sports athlete. I feel like you need to watch things. You know, not necessarily because it's good or bad or whatever, but I think it helps, like for me, it helps kind of give me a little bit more, like it's like game planning. You know, I get to see, you know, some other stuff, to see what other actors are doing, some different takes on different characters and things. Because there, to your point, like about Moss, like there are certain actors who can do so much with so little. And I'm always all about being efficient on the camera if you can. And to kind of dig out those little like nuances. I do another podcast called The Tracklist where we talk about films and their soundtracks. And my co-host, he has this thing where he's like, he's all about the nuances of things, about like not necessarily about what an actor says, but what he sometimes does without even realizing.
Yeah, like the stuff between the lines, like right. All the subtext that's going on, or the way a character reacts. Do you know what, when you talk about soundtrack, the music and the score that I absolutely loved in a recent TV series is Succession. I don't know if you've spoken about Succession, but I love Succession.
I have not seen it yet, so.
Okay, so the score there is absolutely incredible. So I highly recommend that if you know you're interested in and how it supports the drama of it. But also it's just such a strange, I mean, there's a lot of actors up for Emmys in Succession at the moment. Yeah. So it obviously has gone down well, but I mean, some of the performances, just breathtaking and really surprising, because it's a strange genre. It's kind of very dark comedy, but drama at the same time. And then it can flick from making you laugh to making you cry within literally seconds. Mm. And, you know, sometimes the characters can be larger than life, but they are so real. And none of them are likable, and yet somehow very compelling. So it's really confronting, I think, as a viewer when you're watching Succession. But as an actor, watching what those actors do, I mean, Matthew McFadden, who's a producer, and who I've been a fan of for a long time, seeing him play that role of Tom, and I'm sorry you haven't seen it, but you, go and see it.
Don't worry, it's on my list.
Yeah, I'm not going to give you any spoilers, but acting, the score, superb. And if you don't get on with the first episode, keep going with it, because although they're unlikable, they're so interesting, those characters.
Well, I don't mind an unlikable. I like an unlikable character for some. I mean, I think some of the most interesting characters are the ones who, if they were real, they would be despicable. You know, like, you know, because you don't get to. You know, you don't get to experience those, like in real life, you don't want to ever experience those people. Those are people you know. So in order to experience them, you should have these characters to kind of go, oh yeah, okay, I enjoy seeing how terrible of a person he is.
Yeah, it is. It's delicious to watch just how awful they are to each other. And the show has such a, this power of making you hate somebody and then actually a little bit sympathetic towards them for just a moment, and then they do something like, oh no, I should have known.
So you've done horror too, correct?
Yes, that's one of my favorite genres to be in. I mean, actually, I find it quite hard to watch horrors because I'm a bit of a scaredy cat. But I love doing them. One of my favorite ones was Hosts, which
Oh my God, that was so good.
Oh, now there were two. There are two that are very similar titled. There's Host, which was
the host, right.
Yeah, which kind of went viral, which was a seance online, and then ours, which was released at the same time and was also, I think, in the New York's top 10 horror movies that same year.
Yeah.
So it did very well, but it kind of got slightly eclipsed by the other host. So ours was Hosts with an S, and ours was more of a science fiction horror. Yeah. It was kind of a home invasion science fiction. And we did actually at Fright Fest get the prize for the worst death. And spoiler alert, that was me involved in that.
The worst death?
But in the best way, you know, okay. Like the most horrific death.
How
strange accolade.
What's the worst, like, so is it like a death that's so terrible that you like, or is it like?
It's so shocking.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So we actually, as part of our publicity,
like that.
We filmed some people watching the scene where I'm in, where there's the death, and people were just like, oh, it's great. It was really, really very, very shocking.
I call those gasp-worthy scenes.
Yes, most definitely. Yeah, I think horror is a really fun genre to do. And also I was in The Stranger, which is dubbed as well. It's quite art house. But there's a guy called Paul Gerard who's worked a lot on, who's the guy with all the little pinhead?
Oh, pinhead. Yeah.
Yeah, he worked on the origin story for that. He's a very famous concept artist, does a lot of horror, and it was his vision. So that was like a really creepy, supernatural horror as well. And there's a horror anthology feature film, which comprises of four individual creepy stories all told around a campfire.
Ooh, wow.
And that's called Lore, L-O-R-E, and that is premiering on the 24th of August at Cineworld Leicester Square as part of Fright Fest. So that's going to be really great. That's got a couple of actors who were in Game of Thrones, Ben Compton, who my story is with, and Richard Brake, who played the White Walker King. Storyteller. So that's going to be a really nice movie when that comes out. I think it's going to be super interesting. The four horror stories are all different genres. So right. The one I is the creepy ghost story, and then there's like a horror slasher, and then there's like you know, like a cult tribal voodoo type one. Yeah, so it's that's going to be really great. So it premieres next month in London. Hopefully it'll be released soon. So,
wow, that's so cool. I mean, horror films are like, I always wanted to know. So, because I know, like, when you do them, it's different than watching them. But I always wonder, like, I've interviewed a few people who have been in horror movies, and they said exactly the same thing you said, which was, I don't watch them. But I will do one, definitely. And I'm like, but aren't you, like, the scary stuff is happening while you're, I mean, so, you know.
No, I think because you have such a ringside seat to all the effects, so you see the prosthetics going on, and, you know, I mean, I don't want to give too many spoilers away, but I had some pretty horrifying prosthetics in the Stranger, and I had some blood spurting, and all I can remember is being in this freezing cold forest for 6 hours with ice cold blood saturating.
Oh my God!
And you know, just it was that was pretty tough, but also just, you know, a lot of people looking very creepy, but then cut, and then we'd all be laughing together, you know, and in the catering tent. So I don't know, I think it brings you together because they're quite tough. They're also, you know, very serious and very scary, and then cut, and then everyone's having a great laugh, great sense of camaraderie. And then when I actually watch it back, I'm thinking, oh, that was when I was freezing cold for 3 hours, or that was when, you know, that prosthetic kept coming off my face, or, you know, oh, that came out really good. It looks really real. I can't believe it. You know, so I think when you work with, you know about special effects, I think when you work with a really talented team, you're just in awe of them. And then when you watch it back, you're just kind of watching all those little bits back, and it isn't as scary. But when you see other people's reaction, you're like, yeah, I scared them.
And then I was in a theater this past week, and I think they were doing the trailer for The Nun or The Nun 2, I think. And it just occurred to me that, you know, 40% of the scare is the soundtrack behind it. And like, because without it, it's still scary, obviously, but that music just ups the ante that much more. So,
100%. In fact, if I do need to watch something for, because I'm auditioning for somebody, a director who I don't want to know his style, and I have to watch something that I know I'm going to find really scary, I actually turn the sound off and just have subtitles, because it reduces how scary it is for me by half. And then sometimes I fall forward to the really scary bit.
That makes sense. I think, that makes sense. Plus, I mean, you can't be scared all, like you can't, like I feel like you don't want to have to have that experience every time you need to watch something. That would be just like a little crazy to kind of absorb that kind of scare all the time. What I was going to ask you before we wrap up here is, you know, as you're looking back across, like, you know, you have clearly climbed a mountain, you know, after being out of acting for a while, which I commend you a great deal. My question, I guess, is there anything like that you would, like, I guess it's a two-part question here. The first part is, would you go back and tell your younger self anything different? And then the second part of this question is there any piece of advice that you can offer someone who also is trying to do the same thing? Because that is, I'll tell you, I haven't acted quite a while. And I'm actually just starting to creep back into it. And yeah, it is a little difficult, but I'm just curious about your take from it.
So part one, really good questions. Part one, I would say that hold on to the dream because it's never too late to get started and it's never too late to go back. You know, bringing the richness of your life experience back to the table is always going to be valuable. You have a uniqueness because of your life journey and your life experiences that will differentiate you from other actors. And, you know, maybe you spent time raising a family, or maybe you spent time being in a corporate world, or maybe you spent time working on your mental health or looking after an elderly person. But all of these things will, you can bring back to the table as an older actor. I have had, you know, bereavements and other life experiences, joy, sadness, which as an older actor, I can tap into so much more easily now. And also, you know, a lot of actors my age now who have stayed in the business are doing much bigger roles than me. And there's still a place for somebody to do the size of roles that I'm able to access. You know, in the 6-7 years I've been back in the business, I've been able to do a lot of work, and, you know, and I'm doing bigger things all the time. So there's still runway for me to go. And you look at people like Morgan Freeman. I mean, didn't he not really start until he was about 50?
Sure.
And then, you know, there are people who, I think going back to Handmaid's Tale, Anne Dowd, who I love as an actress, she didn't really kind of hit her sweet spot until she was in her mid to late 40s. So sometimes your sweet spot isn't when you're 18 or 20. I mean, I would have said to my younger self, no, you weren't ready then. You didn't have the self-confidence. You didn't have the self-belief. You didn't have the life experience. You know, and I, at that time, I had so much to prove. And now I don't have anything to prove. I'm just enjoying the journey. It's so much fun. I'm enjoying it so much more. And the advice I would give to somebody going back in, part of what I've already said, which is, you know, you have something unique to bring. I would say the business is very tough. So don't come into it looking for validation.
Right. You know? Yeah.
No. There's going to be a lot of rejection. you know, even actors who are regularly working, and I would say I've been pretty lucky, you know, you're going to do 30 auditions and book one role.
Right.
But enjoy the journey. That's my biggest piece of advice. And I think it's something that Bryan Cranston says a lot. He says, you know, go into your audition or do your self-tape, because we do a lot of self-tapes these days, and enjoy it. This is what you do. This is your craft. You know, it's a piece of art that you're creating. Maybe it's just going to be you and the casting director who sees it, but you could be an artist and do a painting, and maybe you don't, you know, it doesn't go on a world stage. It just gets to be seen by family and friends. But you know what? You're an artist. You're creating something really special. So enjoy the journey and don't just think, oh, but that other person just booked a series regular on a show I wanted. Or don't compare yourself to anyone else. Just be your unique self.
Yep.
And the other thing I say to young actors that I mentor is, what is meant for you will not pass you by. Ooh, so there's going to be that part for you. There's going to be that series for you. And you are going to be perfect for it. So be patient. Awesome.
Yeah.
And keep working and hustling and just doing your work. You have to work hard.
You have to work hard. You have to have fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, take it one bit at a time, I think.
Yeah, and don't take the knocks too hard.
I actually, in doing those self-tapes, I've decided I'm just going to have as much fun with these characters as I possibly can, because, you know, I got nothing else. I mean, I'm not Samuel L. Jackson. I don't have the gravitas of, you know, on the screen. So I think there are other things that I can bring. And my thing is, you know, comedy. So I'm just going to have as much fun with it as I possibly can.
What you're good at and bringing that's so important, because they want authenticity. They want, you know, realness. Mm-hmm. You know, talking about Samuel L. Jackson, he just brings his own authentic self. You know, that's very much his personality that you see on screen, and he brings that. Yep. And that's what makes him so interesting and unique. And he's also another person who came into it later in life. So some great role models.
Yeah, him, Harrison Ford, he's another one. You know,
He was a carpenter, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a carpenter, and I think he was like 30 or 39 or 40 years old when he got into it. So you know, it's all possible. It's all possible.
Definitely. If you want it, do it.
So where can people find you online if they want to follow you or support you and keep up with what you're doing and also learn about all the new the stuff that's coming out later on for you?
Yeah, mostly I let people know what's happening on Instagram. So it's Jennifer K. Preston is where you'll find me on Instagram. And that will be the main place where I post updates and let people know when I'm filming and any exciting projects and screenings and festivals that are coming up.
And we'll share that information when we post it up to all the wonderful places where this is shared to. This was amazing. I feel like the people who I'm interviewing recently, we all need to like get together, because we're all Star Trek nerds. It's so weird. Yeah. Like, literally everybody. They're like, I'm a Star Trek nerd. I'm like, wait, what's going on here? I'm like, whoa, is there a convention I missed? Somebody didn't tell me.
I know, because we tend to be in the minority. You know, it's like Star Wars and Star Trek, and we're kind of in the minority, but maybe we're fighting back. Well, maybe all the recent stuff that's been airing, maybe people are shouting it out loud and proud now.
we finally found the Underground Railroad for Star Trek fans.
That's right. We're connecting. We're reconnecting with our inner nerds, and we're proud.
And we're proud, damn it.
Yeah,
Jennifer, I'm so glad we got to talk. I really appreciate you joining me on the show today. You're welcome to come back anytime. And if you ever, like, if you want to come on my other show where we do the podcasts, movies, soundtracks, we nerd out there. You get to pick a movie or a show that has a great soundtrack, and we just nerd out for like an hour. It's hilarious. We actually do one that is, we also have one that's just Bond, James Bond related. That's it. It's Bond related. Wow. Yeah. So we're doing all Bond films and all the Bond related films. So
amazing.
Yeah. It's.
Oh
it's,
yeah. Definitely, we will definitely speak again. That would be wonderful. Hopefully, I'll be in something Star Trek related, and I can come on and talk about that.
Oh yeah, that would be awesome. Yeah. We trust me. Any excuse we can find to talk about nerd stuff, we'll find it. Trust me. So
brilliant. I look forward to it. Thank you, Darren.
Well, that wraps it up for another episode of the Drop the Mic podcast. You can find us online at the Darren Jenkins on Instagram. And you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. So please make sure you like, support, follow us, subscribe. We're on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Music, iHeartRadio, you name it, we're there. Look for us. This episode will be out soon. I'm your host, Darren Jenkins. Stay safe, everyone. Stay cool. Stay hydrated. And we'll see you on the next episode.